Hello and welcome for Computer Graphics. Today we will look into GPU rendering. So last week I told you about rasterization. We were learning how we can rasterize lines and polygons. And you saw that there are quite efficient algorithms available to do that. But nevertheless, if we count all this together, we will see that the rendering or the rasterization problem is very, very compute intensive. So as an example, if you think about programming a computer game, for instance, what you're aiming for is a frame rate of 60 frames per second. That means you have to render a view of your world 60 times per second. And if you have a normal full HD screen, that means you have 2 million pixels. This means you have to set 120 million pixels per second, which is really a lot. Even if you have a good CPU or maybe also a very fast mobile phone, 120 million pixels per second is a lot. And we will see later on that per pixel we will have to do quite a few computations, maybe even lighting computations where we simulate light in a scene and reflection on surfaces and so forth. We have to do that for each of these pixels. So it's not only enumerating these pixels and rasterizing these pixels, but also doing computations for them and so forth. Yeah. So graphics and rendering is very, very compute intensive. And as a result, very early companies and people were thinking about how to accelerate this using dedicated hardware. And not to do it on the standard CPU, but to develop special hardware that is only made to do these computations efficiently. And so the typical way to do that is to use parallelization, because our problem can be rather well parallelized. If we have a scene with maybe 10 to 100 millions of triangles, which is common, it's not unusual, then if you think about the rasterization, for instance, all these triangles can be rasterized independently. Yeah? We can use different processors. Each one rasterizes a single triangle, and this can work. It will need some synchronization in the end if we write to the frame buffer, but it can work. And if we look at computing colors of single pixels, for instance, also this can be done in parallel. So there are many jobs that can be done in parallel. So parallelization is a very good way to speed up that process. And in fact, the result is that dedicated hardware to do graphics is highly parallelized. And usually this hardware is called GPU. So it's a graphics processing unit, not a CPU, but a graphics processing unit. And in fact, these GPUs are, these are often cards that you can plug into your desktop, or they are built in on your mobile computer, or even on mobile phones. They are special units, mostly available or used to do the graphics only. So it's not the CPU, but a dedicated GPU that does all this rasterization stuff. And the CPU only sends commands to the GPU, and it sends data to the GPU. Yeah, first it sends data, and then it sends commands to say, okay, now this is a long list of triangles, just rasterize these. And while the GPU does this rasterization, the CPU can do something else. And so what we see here is a block diagram, or a diagram showing such a GPU. So in fact, this is already, I think, 2 years old, so it's not the latest state of the art, so to say. It's an NVIDIA Titan GTX. And each of these little dots that you can see here, of these green dots, there are some green and some are orange. Each of these dots is a single core. Yeah. So if you think you're cool because your mobile phone has 4 cores or maybe even 8 cores, yeah, this thing has 3,000 cores. Yeah, so there are 3,000 jobs that can run in parallel. And Not only this, but such a GPU also has dedicated units that just do the rasterization. Yeah, so these algorithms or variants of these algorithms that we learned last week are implemented on these GPUs in parallel, so they can very efficiently enumerate these pixels that are within a triangle. And then these cores here are mainly used to compute color for these single pixels. And they are used also to compute transformations on the vertices of our triangles. So we will see in a minute. So this will give us a real pipeline. So to the GPU, we give lots of triangles. Yeah, the GPU then transforms the vertices of these triangles. We have to keep in mind that usually these GPUs are used to do 3D graphics. So first of all, we have to take our 3D world and project it to a 2D image. We will learn how to do that next week. But we've already seen these transformations. Yeah, you remember the stuff with homogeneous coordinates and so on. So first of all the vertices are transformed. Yeah. Then the transformed triangles are rasterized. This is done on special hardware also on the GPU. And then for each pixel, a color is computed. Yeah, and the vertex transformations and the pixel coloring is computed in these single cores. And because there are so many, it is possible today to rasterize scenes with tens to hundreds of millions of triangles on screens of, higher and higher resolution. I mean, full HD, 2 million pixels is already a rather low resolution. Even on mobile phones, pixels are very, very small today. And if you also maybe think in the direction of virtual reality, these virtual reality headsets, for instance, they require rasterization of two images for the left and for the right eye. And usually 60 frames is not enough. They need something like 100 frames per second. So a lot of work is to be done there, and this is what these GPUs here are for. Okay, now luckily, we don't really have to program all this rasterization stuff and so forth on a GPU. The rasterization itself is done in hardware anyhow, but as we will see, nevertheless, we still write programs that are executed on the GPU, in particular that transformation stuff and this lighting stuff. And so it's an interesting interplay between how do we write a program that we can use a GPU to do the graphics that we want. Yeah, so we have to look at the interface, how to transfer data from CPU to GPU, how to send these little programs that we want to use on the GPU from the CPU to the GPU, compile them there and execute them there, and so forth. And there are different APIs available to do that. Probably the most or best known ones are OpenGL and DirectX. And we will look here into OpenGL, at least latest OpenGL is rather similar to DirectX. There are also newer ones like Vulkan. They all have different advantages and disadvantages. And we will look into OpenGL, which also has the big advantage that there is a variant of OpenGL, WebGL, which is available in the browser. Yeah, so we can do examples directly in the browser, again, using OpenGL, and in the browser generate images and graphics with a GPU. If your computer does have a GPU, if not, then there's a software library that does open all this OpenGL stuff, which of course then in the end is slower, but it still works. Yeah, so this makes things convenient. Okay. Good. So, GPUs, what do we have to consider? So, first of all, one of the important things when programming GPUs is that we need to know that GPUs usually have their own memory or at least they have dedicated memory that they can access quickly. And our CPU, has large main memory, and our GPU has GPU memory, which is usually much smaller, but also much, much, much faster. Okay, not much, much, it's much faster. And so this you can see here a little bit, So memory transfer between CPU and memory, of course there are fast buses, but on a GPU the buses are even wider. So much faster memory transfers are possible. So as a result, and these GPUs are maybe dedicated cards in your computer, and they are connected via the normal bus with a CPU. So usually this bus is something like PCI Express. So this is for a desktop computer here. And this bus is even smaller. So when I have a scene on my CPU, which I want to render, what I usually have to do, first of all, is to transfer the entire scene to the GPU memory. And if everything is on the GPU, this is done at startup time, I can say, okay, now run. Now render this stuff and render it quickly. So we first have to upload all the data somehow to GPU memory. And this is normally the first phase of rendering. And then we just say, okay, now render. Now here you have these 100 million triangles. You know the vertices, you know all the data, now rasterize them. And ideally, the world I want to rasterize, I only have to upload once, and then I can simply render it, and I can move through that scene just by changing the transformations. So it's always the same scene, only uploaded once, and then I can render different views into the scene just by updating a few matrices. And then say, okay, now rasterize again. And this is how you move with your player through a scene, just by changing some matrices. Indirectly via keys or something like that. Okay, so now how does a minimal program in WebGL look like? So we will go through the single steps now to simply rasterize two triangles using WebGL. And you will see it's quite some code. It's not like the canvas object in HTML, where I say context.fill, or fill rectangle or something like that. So with one command I get a rasterization. Things are more complicated here. Okay, and the steps are always the following. So first of all, we somehow have to define our triangle coordinates. And you see, now here for instance, this is even only one triangle. It has the coordinates -1, -1, that's the first vertex, 1, -1, the second vertex, and 0, 0, the third vertex. And in the beginning, we write all them into a just normal array in our program. So that's the starting point. We have triangle coordinates and they are somehow stored in an array in main memory in CPU. Next, we upload that data to GPU memory. Then we have to set up these little programs that do the vertex transformations and that also compute the colors of the single pixels that we want to rasterize. These little programs are called shaders. And then we just say to the GPU, okay, now run. And then the GPU runs and does all this rasterization in parallel while the CPU can do other stuff. Okay, and in WebGL, everything or all commands are again issued via such a context object. You remember that from also in the HTML canvas. We could ask the canvas for a context, but there we had to pass the string 2D. Now here we have to pass a string WebGL, and this means the object we get back is now a GL context, and now we can send commands or we can call commands to via this context, and we can issue a command, and then the context itself takes care of communication with the GPU and so forth. Yeah, so this all happens via this GL object here. Yeah, all these commands do the interaction with the GPU. Okay, so let's go through the single steps. So first of all, the triangle data. So up to now, we didn't really care about that. I just told you that a polygon, or that we rasterize polygons, for instance, which is just a sequence of vertices. Now let's say we only have triangles. Yeah, that's our standard basic rendering primitive. And what we can do now is that we simply say, okay, the vertices of our triangle, so let's say this is the triangle we want to rasterize, all the vertices, or we have an array with just x and y of all the vertices in a row. Yeah, so we write it as a one-dimensional array, and you see the corners of the triangle are minus 1, minus 1, that's this corner, 1, minus 1 here, and 0, 1 here. And here you realize that now our coordinates go from minus 1, minus 1 to plus 1, plus 1. And it's not integer coordinates, it's float values. And this is just the convention in OpenGL. Yeah? Lower left is minus 1, minus 1, and upper right is 1, 1. Yeah? So the y coordinate goes from bottom to top in the other direction, like you had it before, and it goes from minus 1 to 1. Okay, so this defines a simple triangle, yeah? But, of course, we do not only want to rasterize single triangles, but really large scenes with maybe millions of triangles. So we need to be able to write multiple triangles, and we can just concatenate all these coordinates, yeah? And if we have, in this simple example, two triangles, now the coordinates are, this is minus 1, 0, that's this coordinate, 1, 0 is this one, 0, 1 is this one, so our first triangle is finished, and then this here is this triangle. Yeah? Okay, and we can write all the coordinates of all the triangles in a row, and you will quickly now realize that maybe this is not so good, because this coordinate here appears twice. Yeah? It's a vertex of this triangle and of this triangle. And in real surfaces that we will describe later on, this will happen very often. In fact, it can be shown that in a normal triangle mesh, which describes a closed surface, each vertex usually is used by six triangles. Yeah, so it's reused six, it's used six times on average. Not always, but on average. So, how can we do that maybe more elegantly? The idea is to use another data structure, which is called an indexed face set. And here the idea now is, we say, okay, this simple triangle mesh consists of four vertices, yeah, here numbered 0, 1, 2, 3. These are these four vertices, so you see now our vertex array only contains four vertices, or eight values, yeah, here it were 12, or six vertices, yeah, now here we have four vertices, but now additionally we need another array which tells us for each triangle always three following values now contain indices that tell us, okay, the first triangle consists of vertex 0, 1, and 2, and the next triangle consists of vertices 0, 3, and 1. So these are indices into this array. So 0, 1, 2 means this vertex, then this vertex, and then this vertex. And 0, 3, 1 means this vertex, then this vertex, and then this vertex. Yeah, and this gives us this here. So this is what we call an indexed face set. And this is the standard data structure that we will use essentially for the rest of the lecture. Yeah, so we always have two arrays. The first one describing the 3D position of the vertices of our triangles in space. That's the geometry. And the second contains such indices, and it describes how to connect these vertices by triangles. Yeah, this is what we call the topology. Okay, yeah, so This is the basic data structure which we will mainly use in the following. Okay, good. So now we understand how we can represent our large triangle meshes, yeah, so large sets of triangles, and by connecting these triangles as we see here, and by reusing vertices, we connect these triangles to what we call triangle meshes. Yeah? And now I told you that in the next step, we have to upload that data to the GPU, to GPU memory. Yeah? This will take some time, but it doesn't matter. Usually it happens just in the beginning when the program is loading. Yeah, this always takes a while, and in that time the data can be uploaded to the GPU. Okay, now how does that work? So to be able to handle that data, we need something like a kind of or something like a memory management on a GPU. Yeah, we need to be able to allocate blocks of memory on the GPU and to give them name, or at least to get handles for these memory blocks. Because most often we won't have a single triangle mesh that we want to upload and rasterize, but have multiple, yeah, for every object in our scene, maybe for every player, for every whatever spacecraft, yeah. We have single triangle meshes, so we somehow need to be able to upload them to the GPU and get a handle for that, yeah, so that we can say now rasterize this one here. And these handles or these objects in OpenGL are called buffer objects. And such a buffer object, and now this is a little bit, yeah, one has to get used to that, are created in the following way. So GL, yeah, that's this context object that we get for a canvas. This this object has a method create buffer. And now this creates, yeah, something like a buffer on the GPU, and it returns a handle. Yeah, so in fact, this is just an integer number. And I think the first one, when you create the first value you get is 1, and the next one is 2, and so forth. It's very simple. Okay, now this is just something abstract, what is called buffer. Next we say, this buffer here, this VBO, now is the current array buffer. And this VBO is bound here as current array buffer. And this array buffer is a constant, and it says it's the current buffer where to get the vertex data from. We will see a diagram in a minute, so that maybe that explains it then a little bit better. Yeah, so now this buffer here is the current array buffer, and then we can upload data, and now this is really the command that starts uploading the data, and now we can upload the data into this current array buffer, and the data we upload is this V here. This is the array in CPU memory, yeah? And this array then, first of all, is converted into another format, into another kind of array, which is an array of 32-bit floats. I mean, that's more an internal JavaScript thing that we first have to convert it that way, because the method cannot directly handle JavaScript array. It first has to be converted like that. And this data then is uploaded to the current array buffer, and because this VBO is bound as current array buffer, this exactly means that this data V now is copied to GPU, and from now on is available under this handle here. And then we have this additional argument here, static draw. I won't go much into detail. This mainly tells us, or is an additional hint for the memory manager, because sometimes if GPU memory, for instance, is full, you can nevertheless still upload data, which is then kept in CPU memory. And the driver itself takes care of swapping memory back and forth. And by this, for instance, you can say it's extremely important that this is in GPU memory, or you can say, okay, I don't care. I mean, it's not so important. and so forth. Yeah, so you can give a few additional hints. For now, we can ignore it or simply always take that one. Okay, here again, maybe how that works. So the idea is the following. We have CPU memory here. We have GPU memory. And here we have the OpenGL context. That's this GL object. Yeah, the GL object handles all these different buffers and so forth. Yeah, and if we make a call, this is a method of the OpenGL context. And first of all, we say, and OpenGL does the interaction with, or this context does the interaction with the GPU. Yeah? We don't know how, and we don't care. It just does it. Okay, so first of all, we say create buffer, yeah, to the OpenGL context. And now it communicates with the GPU, and it generates this buffer object here in GPU memory. So there's no real, next to metadata, there's no real memory allocated yet, yeah, because it's not yet said how large this memory should be and so on. It's just a handle for a piece of memory on GPU. Then we say bind buffer as array buffer. And now the OpenGL context has a number of important buffers. So right now we look at the array buffer. Array buffer is, the name is maybe not very meaningful, but it means the vertex data. Yeah, just the positions of the vertices. Yeah, and now it binds this buffer that we just created with this array buffer. So from now on, whenever we speak about the array buffer, yeah, in fact, we mean that buffer object here in GPU memory. Okay? That's what's called binding. And then we load data, yeah, this buffer data command now loads data, this V array from CPU memory, yeah, that's the data in the array that we've just provide somehow, and it loads this data to the array buffer, and the array buffer points to this object here, so that means now this data is uploaded to the GPU. Yeah, so now you see really the memory is allocated. It just allocates enough space to take this data here. And now in GPU, we have the data in memory and we have an handle for it. It's VBO and currently it's bound as the current array buffer. And if we want to keep several of these buffer objects, now we could reset or bind a new buffer, for instance, and upload and so upload more and more memory to the GPU. Okay? Good. So, it's a little bit, yeah. I found it a little bit difficult in the beginning, but one can quickly get used to it. And exactly the same now we have to do for the index buffer. Yeah, you remember if we have this indexed face set, we do not only have the vertex data, but also the indices that tell us how the triangles are to be set up, yeah, the topology. And we also have to upload that buffer, the index buffer, and we do it exactly the same way. It is just not called the array buffer now, but OpenGL also has an element array buffer. And now we do exactly the same. We create a new buffer here. We bind it with the element array buffer, and then we can upload buffer data. Yeah, and now we upload this index array. Yeah, and before it's converted to 16-bit integer, that's the convention here, to use 16-bit only, which means, yeah, our indices are rather limited, but yeah, also larger indices can be chosen today. Yeah, so these are these two arrays. So in the array buffer, we upload this data. And in the element array buffer, we upload this data. So that means, yeah, to describe an indexed face set, yeah, we need two buffers in GPU memory, the vertex array buffer and the element, or the array buffer and the element array, or the vertex data and the index data. Okay, maybe not very elegant, but it works. Good. So now we uploaded data to GPU memory. We cannot do it for only one object. Yeah, we can do it for multiple objects. Yeah, we just have, for each object, have to create two buffers for the vertex data and for the index data, and have to remember the handles of these buffers. Okay, now the data is on the GPU, and we have handles to access them. Yeah, and now we can say, as I said, now rasterize. Yeah, now you have, GPU has all the data, go and rasterize. And the typical command to do that is draw elements. And what draw elements now does is that it just tells the GPU run, and it tells the GPU to take the vertex data from the current array buffer and the index data from the current element array buffer and to rasterize that. And there's a, as I said, a dedicated, or in fact many dedicated units on the GPU that now do this rasterization that we learned last time. Yeah? So this rasterizer here takes one triangle after the other from memory and rasterizes them. Yeah, and it spreads the work to multiple cores and so forth, yeah, so that many of that runs in parallel. And we don't have to care about that at all. That is all executed now on the GPU. And it doesn't even block. Yeah, so this draw elements just initiates the rasterization and then it immediately returns. So while we execute the following commands, the CPU is now doing all this rasterization stuff and directly writing the data into another buffer, which is the frame buffer. You remember that one. Yeah, so it directly rasterizes now into the image that we want to have, yeah, and fills these pixels here. Okay, and from that moment on, yeah, or for that draw elements here, now all the data already is in GPU memory, so no further memory transfer is necessary. Yeah, so this can all happen local on the GPU, which is also necessary because, yeah, it really, data is moved in an enormous rate on the GPU, so this is only possible within GPU memory. Okay, so that's the general idea. Now there's one more thing that we have to consider. And this is what we call shaders. And shaders are two little programs, normally, that are executed before rasterization on every vertex and after rasterization for every pixel that has been rasterized. So that means before a vertex here is rasterized, this vertex or the vertex data is processed by a little program which is called the vertex shader. And in this program, now we can change our vertex data. We can apply transformations. Yeah? We can move the vertices around and so rotate the entire image or do stuff like that. Later on in 3D, we will, for instance, do the perspective projection also in there, yeah, and do the mapping from 3D to 2D. So every vertex, yeah, before it goes to the rasterizer, it is sent through that little program, the vertex shader. And this program is also executed on the GPU, yeah, but we have to define it in our program. So somehow now we have to take program code in our program and send it to the GPU. Yeah, and the GPU then has to execute that code. We will also see how that works. And whenever the rasterizer now generates a pixel, yeah, or wants to set a pixel on the screen, it somehow has to find a color for that pixel. In our simple examples, we just said set pixel, which means, yeah, set the pixel to black. But that would be a very boring computer game if you only have black and white pixels. You also have to compute colors for your pixels. And this is done in another shader, which is called the pixel or the fragment shader. Yeah? And this shader is called for every pixel that comes out here. Yeah? So if you rasterize an image with 2 million pixels, Yeah, the pixel shader is called 2 million times, at least. And if you have a scene with 10 million vertices, then the vertex shader is called for every vertex in your scene, so that means 10 million times. Yeah, so that's quite a lot of computation, so we cannot do too much in these, and they are rather simple, but they are programmable. And we will see how that works in a minute. Yeah, okay, so that means before we can do the rasterization, we always have to define such a vertex shader and a fragment shader. And these shaders are programs, little programs. They are written in a programming language which is very C-like. Yeah, so you can learn yet another programming language here. The language is called GLSL, so GL shading language. It's very, very C-like. But it has special operations to do geometric computations, for instance. It directly has a matrix type, for instance. It can directly do matrix vector multiplications, cross products, all the stuff that is needed in graphics. But it essentially reads like C. You will see it in a minute. And in this language, we describe the vertex shader, which is called for every vertex before rasterization, and the fragment shader, which is called for every rasterized pixel. And yeah, this is how, for instance, such a vertex shader looks like, or the probably most basic variant of a vertex shader. And okay, this is also something you a little bit have to get used to. This is the entire shader program. Yeah. And the input to that shader program is, or this is usually not a function or a method as you know it from Java, so that you have arguments that you pass in, yeah? And then with return, you give out the result of your method, but instead input and output work via global variables. So this here means we have an input which is called a two-dimensional vector called pos, and in fact this will be the 2D position of the current vertex. Yeah. So right now our triangle meshes, or the per vertex, the only attribute that we have is its two-dimensional position. Yeah, x and y. And this vertex shader gets this x and y in this variable, and the type of this variable is a two-dimensional vector. Yeah, so you see we have a data type vec2, we also have vec3 and vec4, and have a data type mat3 and mat4 for matrices. Yeah, so all these data types that we need here. Okay, so input to our program is the position of our current vertex, yeah? And this program now is called for every vertex. So in that example, yeah, here we have these six vertices, and now for every vertex, this data is copied to the variable pos, and then the vertex shader is called, yeah? And it's also called for this as pos, and for this, and for this, and for this, and so forth, yeah? So this vertex shader is called for every vertex, and the current vertex can be found in this variable pos. Okay, and what is done is defined in a main method, and because it doesn't return arguments and take arguments, yeah, it takes no arguments and it returns void, because the output is also via certain variables. And now the output in that example, or for a vertex shader, the most important output is the variable GL position. Yeah, this is a fixed name. It's always GL position. And in GL position, you have to write the final position of that vertex on the screen. Yeah, so where should the rasterizer in the end rasterize this vertex? Yeah, or where should that vertex end up on the screen in the end? And what we do here now is a very, very simple variant. We simply take that 2D position here and make it a 4D vector. Now the question is, why a 4D vector? So first of all, right now we only do 2D, but we will quickly, on Thursday and latest next week, we will go to 3D. So all our coordinates will be 3D, and as you also learned, homogeneous coordinates are a very, very useful thing. So in fact, we describe all coordinates, our 3D coordinates, by homogeneous 3D coordinates, which means 4D coordinates. Yeah. So we will have to provide the target position on the screen using such a homogeneous 4D coordinate. So we take the 2D point and add a third dimension. We simply add the zero for now, yeah, because we don't use set. We just use X and Y, which come from here. And the one just comes from the homogeneous coordinates. Yeah, it's the one that we added as homogeneous coordinate. Yeah, and this now, this VEC4 here now makes our 2D position to a four-dimensional homogeneous coordinate, and this is stored into GL position. Yeah? And now for each of these vertices from our original data, I mean, in fact, it's not done here on this array in CPU memory, but this is executed here on this data. Yeah? For all the vertices in that buffer object before they are sent to the rasterizer, this pos is set to the vertex shader is called, and then the resulting position from GL position, this is passed to the rasterizer. Yeah? And this is done for all the vertices. Okay. Good. So this allows us, yeah, to generally move objects on the screen. We will also see that in a little demo in a minute. Okay, now there's one thing. Here we say, okay, input to our vertex shader is this 2D variable pos, but we still have to define how this data in our buffer object, how this needs to be interpreted. Yeah, because right now we say, okay, we always have x1, y1, x2, y2, x3, y3, and so forth. Yeah, but in other examples, we will have 3D coordinates, x1, y1, z1, x2, y2, z2. And later on, we will also see examples that for every vertex, we store additional attributes, not only their position, but for instance, also a color. Then we have x1, y1, z1, r1, g1, b1, and then comes x2, y2, z2, and so forth. Yeah. So somehow we have to define in our array how large one entry is. In this case, two float values, in this case, three float values, in this case, six float values, and how the values are to be interpreted. Yeah. In our example, what we want to have is that we have two values, and directly at the beginnings, at index zero, these values should go into the variable pos. Yeah, pos is this input here. And yeah, we will see more complicated with colors on the next slide maybe a few further. And now this is defined in this cryptic code here. Yeah. And again, it's in fact, it looks more complicated than it is. The most important part is this part here, which said, okay, the position attribute, yeah, that's this attribute here. Attributes are inputs to vertex shaders. They are called attributes. And the position attribute for the shader is a 2D attribute. It's of type float. Yeah. Usually all this data is float, but also other data is possible. This false, we don't care. This 8 means that one entry here, the data for one vertex, is 8 byte long. a float has 4 bytes, and because we have 2 floats altogether, it's 8. Yeah, so that means you can find the single vertices at position 0, 8, 16, 24. Yeah, so that's the step width with which the vertices can be processed. And our particular argument pos, yeah, within such a chunk here is at position 0, just at the beginning. Yeah? Okay. Good. So yeah, you see a lot of code to achieve something very, very simple. Okay, here we can see that again. Yeah? And now let's do that for a more complicated example. Let's say for every vertex we have an x and a y coordinate and a color. So in our array buffer, we store them just in a long row. We say for every vertex, yeah, we have these 5 values, 5 floating point values for now. So RGB are also stored as float, which is wasteful, but as an example now it's fine. So altogether that's 20 bytes. And the attribute position is within these 20 bytes is at position 0, and the color within these 20 bytes is at an offset of 8. Yeah. And so we have to write that code down twice. So this is for the attribute. The attribute is two-dimensional of type float. The length of, yeah, from one to the next you get by stepping over 20, and the starting position is at 0. And for the color, it's essentially the same, but it's three-dimensional. And also, yeah, to get from one color to the next, we have to add 20, and we start at 8. Yeah, because it's the third number, 2 times 4 is 8 here, this offset. Yeah. And now by these, yeah, the GPU knows, yeah, how to step from position to position argument and from color to color argument, and it can copy these to corresponding variables, and then they can be processed in a vertex shader. So, yeah, okay. Yeah?
Why would we use then these global attributes if in fact we just use pointers to point to the different coordinates or colors? We could just use a reference and put it into the function as an argument.
You mean these global, these variables here?
Yes.
This is just a kind of programming mental model, how this is done internally. If you access POS, if you access this variable, yeah, this is hidden from the user. You just access the variable POS, yeah, and then somehow it knows how to fetch the value from the right position in your large array of data. That's essentially all it does. Okay? Good. Okay, so that was a very, very simple vertex shader. Now let's say we make something a little bit more complicated. What we now want to do is that we say, okay, instead of just copying the position from here in my vertex shader, what I want to implement now is a functionality that I can move my image and also zoom the image. Yeah. So what I want is that I take my position and that I can add some offset. Yeah, with this offset, I can move the image. And then I multiply it with some zoom factor. Yeah, so all coordinates are a very simple transformation is applied to my coordinates. Yeah, before they are rasterized. And now with just by changing this offset and the zoom variable, yeah, I can really zoom the result and offset the result. And somehow I have to define what the offset and the zoom are. And what we use here for are uniform variables. And these uniform variables, you see the offset is a two-dimensional vector, the zoom is a float. And these uniform values now, they are controlled by my program. That means in this image here, yeah, these are values that are stored here in GPU memory, just one float and a two-dimensional vector. And now before rasterization, before rasterizing my image, yeah, I really, from my CPU memory, I have to set these values directly on the GPU. So this means some memory transfer, yeah, but it's something like 20 bytes or so. Yeah, it's nothing, and the bus is definitely fast enough for that. And so, yeah, these uniform variables, yeah, these are then set or can be reset, easily reset for every frame. Yeah, so we can make a zoom animation by just setting the zoom value, rasterizing again, setting the zoom value, rasterizing again, and so forth. Yeah, and then our image becomes bigger and bigger, as an example. Yeah, so uniforms are variables that can be set globally. And also, again here, yeah, you see we have float, like we know it from C, for instance, but we also have these data types, VEC2, VEC3, VEC4, MAT data types. They are special types, and here you can find a link, a documentation for GLSL. It's really a powerful language that provides you all the math stuff that you need to do graphics, and that we will learn later on here in the lecture. So I don't go into details for now. Okay, so this happens per vertex, and then all this is passed to the rasterizer. Yeah, the rasterizer, or on the GPU, the vertices are transformed, and then the rasterizer does the rasterization. Yeah, the rasterizer is this dedicated unit on the GPU. We don't know how it works, and in fact, we don't really care. But what we see is the result. Yeah, as a result, lots of pixels now are generated, and these pixels are not directly set in the frame buffer, because beforehand we have to compute a color for these pixels. And this now is not solved that we say, okay, from now on, rasterize everything in red or in green or in blue, but in fact, again, we have to provide such a little shader program. And in this case, it's called the pixel shader or fragment shader. That's exactly the same. Fragment is just the older name, but pixel shader probably explain or is the better name to be used. And this pixel shader now just computes a color for each of these pixels. And again, it works like getting the input from a global variable. Okay, so maybe I understand now the question that you just asked. It's not a global variable in the sense that it's the same variable for all shader programs. It's just a global variable for that one invocation of a vertex shader. Yeah, so if you execute the vertex shader 10 million times, yeah, POS is always has a different value. It's not global for all these shader calls. Okay? Just within the code, it's a sort of global variable that is defined at the entrance, and you can directly use it. Okay, and the same is here. Yeah, we will see how we can also pass values in. But for now, the most important thing is to compute the color of the pixel to be set, and this is called GLFragColor. Yeah, like we had GLVertexPosition before. Yeah, now we have GLFragColor. And in that simple example, we simply set it to red. And here you see again that also the frag color is a four-dimensional vector. And now this fourth dimension is not a homogeneous coordinate, but in fact, it's a transparency value. We will also look into that later on. And I think I already briefly mentioned it when we looked into colors, because 3 is a very uneven number. Yeah, we say our pixels have a four-dimensional color, and the last one can be interpreted as transparency, or in fact the opposite, opacity. Okay, this is the color, and this is simply red. So as a result, now we get our triangles rasterized all in red, which is very boring. Yeah. So now the interesting question is, how can we get data into our pixel shader? And the typical way to do that is the following. In the rasterization lecture last week for the scanline algorithm, we were also speaking about shading. Yeah, and we had this example that we were rasterizing a triangle and our vertices had different colors, red, green, and blue. Yeah, and then during rasterization, I've shown you how we can interpolate these colors during rasterization, and we got a very colorful triangle, yeah, where here it was red, here it was green, and here it was blue, and in between it was interpolating these colors. And exactly this we can also, or the rasterizer on the GPU can also do that. So what we can do now is that instead of only having a position, we can also define a color per vertex. Yeah, we were speaking about that here. So now we have an additional attribute per vertex, which is its color. And so our vertex shader, so be careful, this is the vertex shader, this is the fragment shader, so yeah. So our vertex shader now also has this color attribute. And now you see it does not only set the position, but it also sets here a variable C. And this variable C has been defined here. And it's a variable with here the modifier varying. It's a three-dimensional color and it is varying. And varying now simply means the following. This is an attribute that can be set for every vertex. And the rasterizer then interpolates this attribute during rasterization. And the interpolated value now is passed to the fragment shader. The fragment shader has the very same variable, varying vec3c. So these names must be identical. Yeah. And now the rasterizer takes this attribute, interpolates it, and for every pixel that is output, yeah, it writes the corresponding interpolated value here to this variable, and we can use it now in our fragment shader or in our pixel shader. And we can take this C and set it as current color, and now we get this nicely colorful triangle, yeah, which has green here, blue here, red here, and interpolated colors in between. Yeah. So what you see here is that via these varyings, the vertex shader and the fragment shader interact. Yeah? So the vertex shader outputs all information per vertex, its 3D position, yeah, but also other attributes. And we will see other examples, not only colors, but also other different information. Yeah? It outputs that per vertex, and then the rasterizer interpolates all that stuff, and the interpolated values are sent to the fragment shader for the single pixels. Yeah, and then the fragment shader can take this information and compute a color from that. And yeah, the connection between the two are these varying variables. And what that in the end means, yeah, is because they interact, yeah, they communicate via an interface consisting of these varyings. This means that these programs even have to be linked. And this we can see here now. This is how these shaders are defined. Yeah? And you see it's again more and more ugly code. But again, the principle is rather simple. And usually you solve all this by copy-paste, yeah, because it's always the same stuff. So GL has a method, create shader, that create such a shader, and we can say vertex shader or fragment shader, and we will, yeah, there are several different other types of shaders meanwhile available, which we will mainly speak about in, if you hear interactive computer graphics. But for now, we only have a vertex shader and a fragment shader. And yeah, now comes something interesting, yeah, because now we have this shader defined, or just again a handle for the shader. And now we have to provide the code. This code needs to be executed on the GPU. That means we have to somehow give the source code, yeah, this shader as a string, the source code of this shader as a string to the method shader source. Yeah, shader source now sets here this source code. So, in fact, here the source code must be provided as a string, as a long string, with the entire shader source code. And this is set as the current shader source. And then this source code needs to be compiled. So this GL context has a method compile shader, and it compiles this source code. And as usual, such a compiler can generate errors that you have to handle. We will see that in the examples. But it's omitted here because then the code becomes even uglier. And exactly the same we do for the fragment shader. We provide the shader code a source string and we compile it. And then we need to link it, because now we have a vertex shader and a fragment shader, and they interact via these varyings, and the fact that they can interact means that they have the same varyings, and combining them is called linking, like linking normal source code files, and they are linked to what we call shader program. A shader program is just a pair of a vertex shader and a fragment shader that can interact correctly. So we have to generate such a shader program. Then we have to attach the vertex shader and the fragment shader and link that program. And usually there's one shader program, one vertex shader attached and one fragment shader attached, and then the combination is built, and it looks up whether all the varyings that are needed are defined and whether they can interact. And in the end, we have a compiled shader or a working shader program. Of course, again, here errors can appear that have to be queried. But for now, let's assume that this shader program is running. And then, of course, we cannot do that only for one shader program. We can have multiple shader programs. And with GLUse program, we can always switch now between these shader programs and select different shader programs quickly just by switching. Okay. Good. So that was probably the most complicated part. So now what we have? We have all our data on the GPU. We have programs, or at least one program consisting of a vertex shader and a fragment shader on the GPU that tells the GPU how do we have to process the vertices and how do we have to process the pixels. And then in the end comes the call that says, okay, now rasterize. And this method is called draw elements. And again, it has a few parameters. The first one says, okay, we have triangles that we want to rasterize. So in fact, here are also possible lines, for instance, or only points, but we only care about triangles right now. Then we say, in the first example where we don't have an indexed face set, we have six vertices, so process six vertices, which equals two triangles. Our indices are unsigned shorts, and we want to, six vertices from the index buffer, so this is already the indexed face set, and we want to start with triangle zero. So we could also rasterize in chunks, but we usually start at position zero. Okay, good. So that's a lot of stuff, but now let's look at it in a real example. So this is essentially the code that you've seen before in the slides, but a little bit more extended. So in the very beginning, for instance, here, GL is asked for which shading language, for instance, it supports. This shading language, GLSL, is continuously developed, and it already had quite a few modifications. So GLSL 1.0 looks rather different to 3.2 or whatever. So yeah, it makes sense to output that. Okay, but now here the important part. So first of all, here we have our vertex data, and here we won't use, I think it's better to read, right? And now here we don't use an indexed face set yet. So we have 6 vertices. Yeah, this is triangle 1 and this is triangle 2, and we have no index buffer yet. Then we upload the vertex data, we create a buffer. Yeah, this is the vertex buffer object. We bind that buffer and we upload the data. V is this vertex data. So now the vertex data is on the GPU. Then we set up the vertex shader. That's here. The shader is created. The source code is passed to shader source. And you see here the source code comes from this method. And in fact, this method just returns this code here. This is the vertex shader. Yeah? And it's the most simple variant that we had in the beginning. Just take the position and yeah, turn it to a 4D vector and write it to GL position. Yeah? Very simple. This is the vertex shader. And yeah, I also said after compilation, you should also ask whether the compilation was successful so we can query the compile status and give an alert if we, yeah, if there's just an error in the source code, yeah, missing semicolon or something other, or some other error, and then we get an alert. Then we set up the fragment shader, yeah, just the same like before, and this is the content of the fragment shader, yeah, so we have this very simple code. By the way, this precision high P float is a, it's a bit typical for WebGL, and it's required on many WebGL contexts, and it just says in which precision floating point precisions should be made. It's a little bit outdated, but essentially for understanding, you can ignore it. Here, this is the most important part, and it just sets the fragment color to red. Yeah. Okay, so this is our fragment shader. Yeah. Then here we set the shader program. We attach the vertex shader, the fragment shader, we link the program, and we ask for a link error. If so, we get an alert. And then we say use program, and that means now that this shader program that we generated is the currently active program and should be used in the following. Okay, so that was setting up the shader. Then we tell OpenGL how to interpret these attributes. Yeah, and essentially these 3 lines say that in our buffer, array buffer, yeah, there are 2-dimensional float vectors, one after the other, so with a stride of 8, and they should be interpreted as attribute with the name pos, yeah, or they should be provided in the vertex program under the name pos. And then we can draw. And in that example, we use draw arrays, which means always 3 successive vertices are a triangle. So that's the, usually shouldn't switch too fast. But this is this variant, yeah, that we have these, always 3 successive vertices are 1 triangles. This is without an indexed face set. So we also don't have an indexed buffer, yeah. And to achieve this, we simply use this method draw arrays. No, where is it? Ah, here it is. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And if we start that, we get the result here on the right. And now we can play a little bit. Let's play with a pixel shader. I mean, the obvious thing that we would like to try is to change the color. Yeah, so let's say here we set it to green, for instance, and voila, we get a green triangle, or two green triangles. Yeah, we could also make a darker green. Yeah, okay. That's not too exciting, yeah? And in fact, it's very difficult now to do something fancy, yeah, because we do not know where in the triangle are we. Yeah, this program is called for every pixel, yeah, and we have no input variables. Yeah, we have no varyings yet. We will come back to that in a minute. But with the vertices, we can do more interesting things. Yeah. So, for instance, we could simply add an offset. Yeah. So let's say we want to move everything a little bit to the right. Yeah. So we simply add the vector 0.50. Oh. Now there was. What's the? Okay. I cannot change post directly. Okay, that was a stupid mistake. But I can add it here directly and do it. And now everything moves to the right a little bit. Yeah, we could also maybe scale it. Yeah, make it a little bit smaller. Yeah. And now if you remember last week's lecture, we were speaking about transformations. Yeah, you remember we had these affine transformations. What we of course could also do is now that we build up such matrices. Yeah, and we directly transform the points using these matrices. Yeah, and then we can achieve all these rotation stuff and so forth. And we will see a rotation example also here below later on, a little bit later on. Okay, good. So that's the general principle. Now we also have the variant that we have an indexed face set. Yeah, so we don't have, we do not only have a vertex array, but also an indexed array for this indexed face set. This is the corresponding code here. Now it's rather similar to what we had before, but the major difference is now we only have four vertices. And we have this index buffer, yeah, that tells us how from these four vertices we generate two triangles that generate this square here. So we do not only have to upload the vertex data V, but also the index data I. Yeah, so we need this stuff twice. Vertex shader and fragment shader don't change. That doesn't make a difference. And the next only difference is here. We don't use draw arrays, but instead draw elements, which says, okay, also use this index buffer stored in element array buffer or so to get the topology. But otherwise it's identical. And if I start it, I get this again. Yeah, pixel and vertex shader exactly work like before. There's no difference here. Okay. The next extension that we want to look at is now adding color. Yeah. And now our vertex data becomes more complicated because for every vertex, we do not only have the position X and Y, but now for every vertex, we also have a color. So the first vertex is at position -1, 0, and it's green. The next one is at 1, 0, and it's also green. Then there's one at 0, 1, which is red, and one at 0, -1, which is blue. Yeah. That's what we want to achieve. Index buffer again is the same. Even uploading this buffer is the same. Yeah, it's just a larger array now. More data has to be uploaded. But what is more complicated now is if we look at the vertex shader. In the vertex shader, now we have these two attributes, the position and the color. Yeah, and now for every vertex, when the vertex shader is called, the position and the color are set according to these values. And furthermore, what we want to do now is that we take this color and pass it as a varying to the fragment shader. So we want to interpolate these colors, yeah? And so we have to define a varying C, and we have to set C to this color from the vertex. Yeah, that's all. Just the C now is automatically, because it's varying, is automatically interpolated during rasterization and passed to the pixel shader. Yeah, and the pixel shader now has this varying C as an input, and we simply set the fragment color now to this interpolated color C, and the result looks like this. Yeah, now we have color values, green, green, red, blue, as demanded. Yeah, and yeah, so we can now get more interesting information also to the pixel shader, and we will see many more examples what we can do in a pixel shader. Later on in the pixel shaders, for instance, we will do a complete lighting simulation. That means for every 3D point on a triangle, we try to we know that the surface is illuminated by a light source at some position, and then we compute the angle under which the light source illuminates that surface and the angle under which we look at, and whether there's a reflection or a glossy reflection, and do real lighting computations in that pixel shader. Yeah, but for this we need to know the surface normal and so forth. Yeah, so examples will become quickly much more complicated. Okay, and finally, as a last example, I would like to show you now also a more complicated vertex shader. So what we do in this example is that we apply a simple affine transformation in the vertex shader. So you see, for POS is the input point, and we take this, the coordinates x and y. So you see dot x and dot y extract the corresponding components of a vector. And we multiply these components with two other vectors, yeah, which span now a rotated coordinate system. And essentially by this here, yeah, we compute a rotation, and then we pass this p as final GL position. And if we apply that, yeah, we get a slightly scaled and rotated version of our very simple scene. Okay. Good. Is that understandable to some degree? I mean, it's yeah.
Where's the point? Which 2D coordinates are displayed? Is it always -1, 2, 1?
Yes. It's always -1, 2, 1. GL position expects the coordinates in the range of -1, 2, 1. You can define coordinates outside this range, then automatically triangles are clipped. Yeah, so they are cut at the boundary, but GL position definitely expects between -1 and 1, and the rasterizer expects it there. In your array, you can take arbitrary coordinates, yeah, because in the vertex shader you can scale and whatever do with them what you want anyhow. Yeah, so in the end, your scene can be from 0 to 1,000. Yeah, but then you have to scale it accordingly so that it's in the range from -1 to 1 on your final image. More questions? I mean, it's clear that you cannot immediately reproduce the code here. Yeah, and it's also, we will provide template code. Yeah, so that you can get quick first results like the one here. I will try to, this week, finally, we will make it that I can give you links for instance, also to this demo, so that you can directly in your browser, write new vertex shader code and experiment and play a little bit around with it. And also here in the source code, experiment and maybe add other attributes or stuff like that. Yeah, please do so. It's the only way to understand all that. I mean, in the end, it's not complicated. Yeah, it's just lots of code that is needed to generate the first triangle. Yeah, what I can also say, there's a newer library around, which is called Vulkan, which is has even more possibilities to optimize graphics programming and so on. And I think to generate the first triangle, you need 1,000 lines of code. Yeah, so this is still lightweight compared. Okay, so this we had. Okay, now one more remark. Up to now, we were always only looking at single images. That means I've shown you code now to rasterize a single triangle. And whenever in this demo, if you press the Do It button, yeah, then it renders a new image. But normally, what we have to think about is that we have something interactive, yeah, like a computer game or a virtual reality application or so. And there we don't render single images, yeah, and then wait, but instead we have a virtual dynamic world. Yeah, so we continuously want to render this. And ideally, we really re-render, or we render a frame, display it, and then immediately start rendering the next frame, yeah, so that we can quickly show the next view when the user moves, for instance. Yeah, we move the camera a little bit forward, re-render the next frame, and show that next frame, and then immediately start rendering again the new frame, so that the user has the impression, yeah, that there's a continuous movement. And we have to do that re-rendering, or be able to re-render, yeah, ideally at something like 60 frames per second, for instance, if you have a computer screen, because the image on a normal computer screen changes 60 times a second, yeah? So every time the screen can display a new image, it should display the new view, yeah? So we want to render 60 times per second. Other screens are maybe faster, have higher frame rates, yeah? And then we need to be even faster. And this loop that always re-renders, yeah, and that essentially never stops, it just renders the scene for the current view, this is called the render loop. And there are a few things that are maybe interesting, and one is, of course, what we don't want to do is that we want to watch the GPU rendering a scene. We don't want to have that we see, okay, now this triangle is rasterized, now this is rasterized, now this is rasterized. But what happens, in fact, is that usually we always have two frame buffers. We have a frame buffer, yeah, one and two. And when we render into one frame buffer. And while we render into that frame buffer, the other frame buffer is visible on the screen. And as soon as the new frame buffer is rasterized or is finished, we simply swap these pointers. That means we say to OpenGL to WebGL, now this frame buffer is the latest one, and this one is displayed on the screen. And we start re-rendering, and now we rasterize the next image into the second frame buffer. Yeah? And if that one is done, we go back to this state, yeah? So in this render loop, we always change between, or we always swap these two buffers. And this is an operation, yeah, which is called, for obvious reasons, swap buffers. So we always have something which we called a front buffer. This is the visible one. This is the displayed frame buffer. And we have the back buffer. This is the buffer in which we render, yeah? And as soon as the back buffer is finalized, has finished, yeah? We say swap buffers, or we say swap buffers, and this means as soon as the back buffer is finished, yeah, automatically these two buffers are swapped and we can start re-rendering the next view. And this is called the render loop. And now if you do it as I said, yeah, and you have a good GPU, then something like this might happen. You get images that look like this, and if you look here closely, you will see that there is a visible edge, and there's also one here, which is a little bit more subtle. Here at the tree, you can see it. And what happens here is the following. A screen, when we do that swap buffers, from here to here, for instance, the screen does not immediately show the new frame buffer, but instead the content of the new frame buffer also has to be transferred to the screen, yeah, via your HDMI cable or whatever cable. Yeah, so the new image has to be transmitted. And this takes a while. Yeah? And what happened here now is that here a swap buffer has happened. Yeah? Then the new image was displayed from here on. And when the display was here, yeah, your render engine was so fast that already the next buffer was available. Yeah, so from here on, suddenly already the third frame is displayed, yeah, and then somewhere here, maybe the fourth is visible. And so you see these lines, yeah, and they can run through your screen, yeah, and you see how your screen is sort of split. Yeah. And this is called tearing. And in fact, that's very wasteful, yeah, because you only a fraction of your rendered image is displayed, yeah, and before the bottom part of your image sort of can be displayed, already the next image sort of overrides it. And so what is typically done is the following, that when a swap buffer is demanded, usually your computer waits for the so-called vSync. vSync is the moment when the screen starts with a new image at the top line. Yeah, your screen or the image is transferred to the screen, and the screen generates this new image from top to bottom. And when it finalized its image, yeah, and wants to restart at the beginning, this is the moment where the swap buffer is executed. And from then on, the screen displays the new image, yeah, and from that moment on, you can also restart with a new scene. Yeah, so the swap buffers, the normal swap buffer method does not immediately swap the buffers, but it waits for the next vSync. Yeah, for the next, when your screen starts displaying the next image. And by this, because yeah, this only happens typically 60 times per second, yeah, automatically the swap buffers blocks until the next frame is available, and then you can restart rendering. Yeah, and I mean, if you're slower than 1/60th of a second, yeah, then your last image will be displayed for multiple frames, but the switching always only happens just in between single frames, so that this tiering disappears. Okay, and now this is essentially the structure of how such an interactive application usually looks like. We have this fast render loop here. Yeah, that's what we've just seen here. But before, we have an initialization phase in which we upload our buffers and compile the shaders and so on. Yeah, this is kind of, so to say, the loading screen of your application. Then we have the fast render loop. Yeah, where we render all the scene all the time. And in between here, in this render scene, we only do fast operations on the GPU, like binding buffers, using shaders, and so on. These are operations that can be done very efficiently, yeah, or calling draw elements and stuff like that, and that don't require that you send much memory, much data between CPU and GPU memory. Yeah, so ideally, do all the complicated, costly stuff here, and then here do everything as fast as possible, yeah, with only minimal interaction between CPU and GPU, so that it can happen as fast as possible. Okay, and yeah, this is just a little side remark. Yeah, of course, multiple buffers can be set as well as multiple shader programs. But this is very, very simple. And in the render loop, yeah, we cannot only render then one object, but multiple objects. And for each object in the render loop, yeah, we just switch programs, for instance, by shader program. Now another shader program is used, and this is just a switch. Yeah, the program all is already available on the GPU from the initialization phase. And here we only switch. Yeah, this is just resetting some pointers that can all be done very fast. And this can be done in the render loop. So there are operations that should be avoided within the render loop, like compiling a shader, for instance. Yeah, that's very costly. So that should be done in the initialization. Okay, and this swap buffers works a little bit differently in OpenGL and WebGL. But yeah, that's not so important here. Next lecture, we will look into transformations. Yeah, so what we do in the vertex shader here, you've seen the little example where we rotate it, and we've already seen how we can do that with matrices and homogeneous coordinates. And yeah, on Thursday, we will look into that more deeply. And as a preparation for next week, where then we go from 2D to 3D, and we'll have perspective cameras and all that stuff. Thank you.